The world has ushered in the new year hoping for health, wealth, and prosperity. It's also the time of the year when people look around them to lend a helping hand to the most vulnerable groups in need during the cold winter season. On today's Zoom In segment, we have the honor to be joined by a true pioneer and compassionate advocate, Dr. Jim O'Connell, who has been dedicated his career to the medical service of the homeless population in the U.S. for over 4 decades. From the gritty streets to corridors of policymaking, Dr. O'Connell has been at the forefront of curing the unhoused. Without further ado, we now connect with Dr. O'Connell, the founding physician and president of Boston Healthcare for the Homeless. Good morning and happy new year to you, Dr. O'Connell.
Same to you. Great to be here. Happy new year.
Happy new year. There are countless articles I've stumbled across, but for our listeners who are just tuning in, maybe you can walk us through the beginning of your 4 decades-long journey. In past interviews, you said you stumbled into the role by accident. How did you first become involved in helping the homeless?
Well, serendipity certainly has played a huge role, and I often think of myself as an accidental tourist over these last 4 decades. But, you know, I went to, got to medical school when I was relatively, I was 30 years old when I got to medical school, did my 4 years of medical school, 3 years of residency, and I was all prepared to go become an oncologist because I was fascinated by cancer and end-of-life care. And right as I was finishing my residency, the city of Boston was getting a grant to try to take care of at what at the time was this kind of new burgeoning of homelessness where folks were coming into the emergency room and the thought was, why don't we get out and take care of them before they come into the emergency room? Mm-hmm. And the homeless people that put together the grant together with the mayor of our city and the mayors with a people recipients of the grants, they insisted that they have a full-time doctor and they couldn't find one. So I got called into my chief of medicine's office, and for the, any of your audience who happens to be doctors, you know that when you get, that's like getting called into the principal's office. And he and another mentor of mine suggested that I would take a year off and do this for a year, and they would delay my fellowship. And it was very hard to say no, but I knew nothing about homelessness and essentially did this as initially as a what I thought was going to be a year of giving back, a year of doing good before I went on to do my career. So it was truly accidental. I ended up in the shelter, never having been in a shelter before. And I was all of a sudden the doctor working with these ferociously wonderful nurses who had already been there.
And you've somehow been part of it for 4 decades. I don't really believe in serendipity, but maybe I should.
The older I get, the more I believe it. So I think serendipity has a big role to play, but I think you also, sometimes serendipity points you in the direction you feel like that's where you belong. I think when I found it, I did this for a year and said, boy, I need one more year. It was so complicated. And then I think at the end of 2 years, I realized this is what I really want to be doing. Mm. So I've been blessed. It's really, it's been just a great job that has never been boring. Is always something changing, and it's been wonderful.
Dr. O'Connell, I'm sure you get this all the time, but just speaking to you is absolutely humbling. It makes me think about what more I can do to perhaps help immediately the most vulnerable people that I see, not just on the news, but maybe just my regular walk to work. I think back and reflect as we start a brand new year. Let's maybe walk our listeners through some of the works that you've dedicated your career to. You've pioneered a community outreach van to connect with the homeless, which you refer to as your spiritual home. Can you tell us a little bit about the van and its significance?
Oh, I'd be happy to. And in full disclosure, what we have in Boston is a really rich and longstanding shelter system where about 90% or more of everyone who's homeless in Boston ends up in one of our shelters. But there are these really, I would say, feisty and a sort of interesting group of people who do not come into the shelters, even though there's time. And we realized as we were doing clinics in the shelters and the hospitals, the people living outside, which we call rough sleepers, or they call themselves rough sleepers, were the ones who tended to be dying in the cold weather and in the hot weather. And we weren't doing a very good job of getting to them. So with help from the state of Massachusetts, the Department of Public Health, there was money given to one of the shelters, one of the main shelters in Boston, to operate a van that goes out every night of the year from 9 at night till 5 in the morning. Mm. And through a whole bunch of interesting meetings, it was not a medical van, much to my chagrin, but a van that brings soup and sandwiches and blankets. Because in fact, the homeless people living outside really wanted, they didn't want a doctor at nighttime. What they really wanted was, you know, something that would keep them alive, give them food, clothing, shelter. But on the good side, the people that ran the van every night allowed me to join them for a couple and sometimes three nights a week. And I could serve soup and sandwiches and stuff, but also say, hey, if you need anything, I happen to be a doctor. So I learned that that's where I got to understand, first of all, how these folks who are out every night driving this van really earned the trust of everybody out there. Mm. They were consistent. They were always there. And I get to piggyback on that trust. So people on the streets, I got to know them through these folks, and then over time, I've gotten to know, or I certainly had gotten to know, almost all the people living outside. And that's where you really see what's going on from my perspective. So my clinical practice is basically working with a really dynamic team that we call our street team that takes care of those folks and tries to do whatever care we can outside, but also make sure it's comfortable for them to come into either our clinics at the hospital or in get admitted to the hospital, or we have a respite program where they come. So the van has really been like ground zero. And I think the people that run that van are the real true heroes in the story, not us.
You're all too humble. Okay, but can you tell us a little bit about the respite program that you just mentioned and maybe other programs and initiatives that your institution has been involved in over the years?
Sure. And by way of, you know, full disclosure, as much as I had all these great ideas, I thought when I started of how we should do care for homeless people. But one of the criteria that the Robert Johnson Foundation, who gave this grant to the city, made was that the mayor had to sit with a coalition of stakeholders, meaning homeless people, and find out from them how they wanted to be served. And they had really strong ideas. They met with the mayor through the whole winter time of 1984-85 and came up with several things that they demanded. Most dramatically was that they wanted continuity of care. That's why they wanted a full-time doctor. They didn't want, you know, people coming on Monday night and then not again for three Monday nights, or volunteers showing up, even though that's what I thought we should be doing. I believe in volunteerism. They wanted consistent full-time people. But they also made these kind of interesting demands of us, the doctors, and they were angry that we would frequently discharge people from the hospital after major illness, discharge them back to the streets or back to the shelters where they still had to be out walking all day when they were way too sick to do that and very vulnerable. And most people get to go home and you have your family and you have supports and, you know, food and some regularity. But these folks had no safety. So they turned to the mayor, who was in this, and they said one criteria is that we had to set up what they called a respite program. And by that, they just meant someplace when they're coming out of the hospital and way too sick to withstand the rigors of daily survival in the streets, where we could have 24-hour nursing and doctor care to take care of them. And that has become our respite program. So that started back in September of 1985. And you know, we've had to adjust as the healthcare system has changed radically here, where hospitals used to keep people for relatively long periods of time. Now it's really for shortened lengths of stay. So we are taking people who are sicker and sicker into our respite program to make sure they're safe and not dying out on the street.
But it just sounds like a lot of moving parts to ensure that there's great infrastructure. If someone's extremely sick, that there is a respite program, that there is this expectation of continuity, as you've said, and consistency. And that just seems to be not just a single person kind of effort. You need the government on your side. You need the local government to be doing, or at least being on the same page as those who are on the front line.
Oh, you're so right to say that, because I think one struggle for homeless programs around the country is how you can, you know, is it supposed to be a charitable endeavor or should it be part of the government investing in doing this? Because it's a group of people who really need high quality, continuous care because they're very sick. And so what we learned by, even though it was homeless people pushing the mayor to do this, we early on had the support of this in our country, it would be the state of Massachusetts and the city of Boston. And they were incredible partners, but they also, interestingly, made us all stay part of we have 12 academic teaching hospitals inside Boston, which is relatively small. But when homeless people got sick, they knew they were going into those hospitals, and they wanted their doctors and nurses and teams, healthcare teams, to not just be out in the community, but be able to be part of the hospitals to make that continuity clear. So it was really interesting. The respite program was seen as a go-between between the community and shelter world and the hospital world. And so the same doctors and nurses who take care of them out in the community also can see them in the hospitals and also take care of them in respite. So the continuity is really through the clinicians and the nurses and the social workers, et cetera. So it was pretty brilliant. That was all conceived by homeless people though, and then agreed to by the government. So our respite program is essentially funded by the healthcare system in Massachusetts with help from the federal government. And I think it's a very, it's a very involved endeavor. It's 24-hour care for people that have a huge burden of co-occurring medical, psychiatric, and substance use disorders. And it requires a lot of work that would be very hard to sustain with just a grant or just a charitable. You need that, of course, but it's the government that you need to really substantially fund it.
Dr. O'Connell, from afar, I think there are certain myths about the homeless people, generalizations that are absolutely misled, that they would depend too much on alcoholism or drug abuse, and that if we made a direct donation to a homeless person, that they might abuse it. And it's so far removed from the truth as to why some of these people end up on the streets. In fact, I'm seeing more studies. There was a San Francisco-based nonprofit that asked and implemented a fresh question to tackle homelessness in two California cities, if I'm not mistaken, San Francisco and Los Angeles. They just asked a really simple question. If 100 homeless people were given $750 per month for a year, no questions asked, what would they spend it on? And it was basic necessities, food, housing, transportation, far removed from our hasty judgment of will they rely more on substance abuse. From your observation that spans over four decades, what are some of the main reasons that are driving these people out of their homes? Is it true? Is it really unaffordable housing as a culprit? And of course, the bigger question is, what more can be done about it?
Wait, it's a very profound question because it is a very complicated issue. But I couldn't agree with you more. I'm so glad you pointed out those studies because those studies sort of echo what I think most of us have noticed over time, is that with some extra income, people who are homeless will use that wisely. It's not something that will be squandered any more than any of us would squander a little extra money. But I think might be what I found the most helpful metaphor was one that was told to me. There was a woman named Cushing Dolbear back in the 1980s who was a fierce advocate for homeless people and underserved people. And she had a vision of homelessness as a game of musical chairs. And what we did, certainly in our country, was took away some of the chairs because we stopped building housing. And when you take away chairs and then you stop the music, the visual that I keep in mind is that the person who's going to be left without the chair is usually the person struggling with, somebody who's on crutches or somebody whose thought disorders are keeping them from paying attention to the music. So what you end up doing is kind of artificially thinking that the people with mental illness or severe illnesses or disabilities are what caused their homelessness. When in fact, if there had been enough chairs, you wouldn't have seen that. So there's always been a little, a little kind of resonance back and forth between we need more housing. With more housing, we might not be talking about mental illness and everything else. On the other hand, the reality is that the people who have ended up out on the streets and in the shelters long-term are those who are facing way more obstacles than most of us know. And I think what it does for most of us who, if you get to know people over time who are on the streets, you realize that whatever you thought in the beginning, that first impression is inevitably way wrong. And what they have lived through, the stories of their lives, are often full of real courage and resilience in the face of really insurmountable odds. So it converts that in from a, it's all about drugs and drinking and stuff into these are people who have really struggled and are really worthy of us doing whatever we can to help them out.
Can you maybe share with some of our listeners some stories about some of the homeless people that you've come across and some of their stories that struck with you the most?
Oh, yeah, I could, you know, there's a litany of stories that would be fun to share. But if I were to pick out a couple, you know, there is a woman, one story that has always struck with me is there's a wonderful woman who lived on the streets. We used to see her every Monday and Wednesday night when we're on the van. And she was living on a doorstep down in the financial district of Boston, had a real trouble with drinking and alcoholism because she had lost everything. And over time, we used to bring her sandwiches and soup and stuff on the van and try to earn her trust. And over a number of years, we sort of earned her trust, even though we didn't get her off the streets. But then she got sick and needed to come to our respite program because she needed pretty severe surgery, but the surgeons were very reluctant to do it because her life was so unstable. So we let her stay in our respite program so that we could show our colleagues, the surgeons, that she had enough residential stability, they called it, and could stay sober for about 6 months. So the surgeons then agreed to do the surgery. And I remember she called me in on a Sunday, and it was not a long time before she was going to have the surgery. And she asked me if I would take her picture. You know, and we, up until that time, you know, I never would take a picture of anybody's face because we thought that was kind of voyeuristic or taking advantage. Well, I would do clinical pictures so that I could show medical students and residents how to take care of certain infections or infestations, but never faces. And anyway, I took the picture and I blew it up. I went in to do it. She was in her room in our respite program and she had gotten all dressed up. I'd never seen her in anything but what she used to call her rags. And she put her hair up in a bun, had lipstick on, nail polish, really looked kind of elegant, had shoes on. And then she'd gone outside and gotten some flowers and put them in the styrofoam coffee cup and put it on her bedside table. And I took this picture. And you know, I wanted to do oncology and end of life care. So what came through to me was she's frightened to death of this surgery. I'm going to talk to her about her fears. So I sat down and said, "You want to talk about death or any of this?" in the best way I could. And she looked at me like I was a little strange. And then she said, "Oh my gosh, not at all." She said, "I've been living in the streets for the last 20 some years and I face death every single night. In fact, most nights I would welcome death because it's so awful out there." And then she turned around and she said, "No, this is a picture I want to have in case either of my two daughters, who were 3 and 5 years old when I last saw them, and that's now 20 some years ago, in case either of them wanted to go looking for their birth mother, she wanted to be sure there was a picture of someone they could at least, you know, be proud of." And, you know, kind of breaks your heart when you hear that. But I was completely wrong at what was going on. And so I forever think of that picture as one that sort of changed my vision of what was really going on. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing, by the way, is when I came back, I gave her that afternoon, I blew it up, put it in a frame, and I came back. Then 2 days later, I was back in our respite program, and there were literally 22 people who asked me to take their portraits. Mm-hmm. And we realized that there is a part of, you know, these are people just like you and I, and they're passing through this life and they want to have something they can be proud of, remembered for, you know, and at a time when they're looking good. So we've all realized that people want to tell their stories and they want to have their stories told with some dignity and compassion.
And have their stories be heard. Thank you so much, Dr. O'Connell. Insightful and I think eye-opening in many ways. We appreciate you joining us. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm so honored to be here. Good luck.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
If you're listening to our program using the podcast service, just a reminder that we do go live Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. Korea Standard Time. So tune in and help us make the show more informative by giving us your input. See you bright and early on Good Morning Seoul.